And good morning. Look at that. Just like that, we've made it to the day before Friday. I like to call it Friday Eve. And we are on the cusp of the weekend. Rafael Goyeneche is going to join us in the 12 o'clock hour. And as you know, every time we get the president of the Metro Crime Commission in, he has some amazing insight and usually some developing and or breaking information that you're not going to hear anywhere else. And today he's going to bring us an update on the investigation into the alleged battery committed by St. Tammany Parish Sheriff Randy Smith and the tentacles that we've seen grow from that incident. He'll also tell us about the five arrests in the Republic nightclub mass shooting and why Leon Cannizzaro is retiring from the Attorney General's office, among other issues that he'll handle for us in the 12 o'clock hour. Next hour, we'll have the Port of New Orleans show, and we'll have time to talk to you on the Oakwinart Jewelers Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870. I have a bunch of topics I think you might want to chat about today, and we'll open it up for anything you want to bring to the table. But this hour, we're going to start by talking about the U.S. Senate race in Louisiana, and most specifically, the Republican runoff, with early voting starting tomorrow. It feels like there is far less hype and excitement about the runoff than there was about the primary, now that the incumbent has been eliminated from the ballot and will not be returning to office. Not seeing as many ads, not hearing as much interest, and not hearing as much buzz about this race, with early voting one day away. So we wanted Joshua Stockley, a professor of political science at the University of Louisiana, an analyst frequently on WWL, to join us and help us figure out what's going on. Hey, Josh, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here. I have been seeing a lot of ads in this race recently that are targeting and attacking what we thought was going to be the man who had no chance of winning this race. But the fact that they're running ads against him shows me that maybe, just maybe, he is mounting a pretty good campaign. What is the latest? What are polls telling us? And what are you seeing out there to tell us who's winning this race and what the future holds?
Yeah, you know, by all accounts, Representative Letlow is in a strong, commanding front runner position. You know, you mentioned it seems like a lot of the hype has been removed from this race. And I would agree with Senator Cassidy being defeated and no longer in the election. I think part of the reason is, you know, the incumbent, the individual that drove the competition, is out. And there is an operating understanding, maybe understanding is the wrong word, but there is just a conventional belief out there that Letlow has this race wrapped up.
But then if that's true, and if her campaign feels like she has it wrapped up, why would Julia Letlow be actively campaigning and spending money to campaign against John Fleming? I'm seeing so many attack ads on Fleming that it makes me think her campaign must think he's got a real shot at this thing.
I mean, anybody's got a shot until the final poll has closed and the final ballot has been cast. So you can't take anything for granted in politics, whether you've got a 40% lead or no lead. And so I think Representative Letlow and her staff are operating under the assumption that this is a new race, a fresh beginning, and she has to approach John Fleming the same way she approached Senator Cassidy, and don't take it for granted and close it out.
You know, we talked to John Fleming right after the primary, and we've asked Julia Letlow to join us dozens of times, and her campaign literally just ignores us and has no interest in having her come on the radio or do any other media interviews. I haven't seen her doing any media. That seems to be a strategy, though, that they just want the ads to speak for themselves. They want the fact that the president endorsed her to be the ringing message out there, and they don't want her to be subject to having to answer questions from reporters or talk show hosts, because why would they when she appears to have a comfortable lead?
Yeah, you know, it's two sides of the coin. On the one side, I say this is bad for democracy. This is bad for the citizens. I think any candidate, regardless of their status, should make themselves freely available to the media, to the public, and to each other. And so when you decline to participate, I think you're doing public service and democracy a disfavor. However, it is the classic rule of political campaigns. When you are the heavy front runner, you generally pull back from public appearances. The idea is, you know, you might say something off, and whether it's intentional or purely accidental, you're trying to reduce the odds of a slip up that might cost you something. The ads are safe. That is a controlled message. That's a controlled theme. Everything there is controlled. So when you go live, you know, you're opening up for the unknown, and you don't want any unknowns at this point in the race.
Yeah, and you don't want to make a mistake. I mean, it's clear. Right. You don't want to say something that could hurt your lead. I guess it's like a football team just running the ball to try to run the clock out in the fourth quarter of a game with a comfortable lead and not risk an interception or a turnover and do everything you can to protect that lead. I get it. Like you, I think it's unfortunate. And I don't think that we should have laws that require debates or require access to candidates, because I don't think that that's in the spirit necessarily of how we like to run our democracy. But at the same time, I do think it is unfortunate that we are seeing more and more where candidates refuse to debate, refuse to make public appearances, and want the very controlled message that they put out on airwaves and social media and through text messaging, and never allow anyone to question their positions or challenge them on whatever they may need be challenged on.
Correct. I mean, you're a public official. You should, regardless of your position at the most local level or the most federal level, you should be accountable and you should be available to answer any and all questions. And you're right, legislating won't solve this problem, nor should it probably be legislated.
Yeah, you know, and especially in this day and age where we have such visceral conversations and attack ads and posts on social media and everything else, I really want to know the truth. I really want to have an opportunity, and not necessarily will we always get the truth from being able to ask those questions, but at least we can get closer to it or see, you know, I want to ask, I have never heard Julia Letlow respond to some of the very specific attacks against her and claims made against her. I've never heard her deny them. I've never heard her confirm them or explain them. And to me, as a voter and as a journalist, that does concern me, that I want to know, wait, is this true? Did she really do the things that her opponents claim she did, or that the political action committees are asserting that she did? How much truth is there to this, if any? But she won't give us that opportunity.
Yeah, you know, and that's, again, that is difficult. Whether it is John Fleming or Julia Letlow, I think if you are running for office, you make yourself and you should be available to answer every question and answer them as directly as possible, not counting obvious social, you know, national security or maybe some intensely personal family situations. You know, you're a public official, you know, like, for example, Letlow's comments on DEI. You know, where do you stand? Where are you? What's the accurate record? Those are fair questions. And I don't think Julia should evade those. And I don't think Fleming should evade any equal questions as well.
Yeah. You know, that's very specifically one of the things I'd love to ask her about, these attack ads that claim that when she was a university administrator, she was very pro DEI and was promoting and pushing policies that are now very frowned upon by the right wing Republican majority. And not to be critical, or but to say, OK, did you believe that then? Do you still believe it now? If not, why not? But again, we make the requests and we will continue to make the requests and see what happens. I don't want to harp on that. As voters go to the polls tomorrow, starting early voting, we really have seen a shift where it used to be that Election Day was the crescendo. Election Day, we saw a race up to Election Day before this widespread early voting that we have now. Now, early voting is so popular that really, if candidates haven't gotten their messages out by now with early voting starting tomorrow, then they haven't run a great campaign, have they?
Yeah, you know, the campaigns have shifted. There really are two campaigns. And the first campaign is you're trying to reach the people that are most likely to vote early. There's a convenience there. And a lot of people are taking advantage of that convenience. So, you know, step one is, you know, you've got to hit your messaging early and clear. The bad thing is if you're a little bit behind, you know, 2-3 weeks out, like a John Fleming, it makes it very, very, very difficult to catch up if, you know, a 10th or 20% of the eligible voters have already cast. But you can still push. And, you know, again, it's not over till it's over. This is still a time to be aggressive and make your last minute case to, one, remind people there's an election, and two, why they should push the button for you and not your opponent.
We're talking with University of Louisiana political scientist Josh Stockley about tomorrow's early voting. And we are focused very, very much so on the Republican runoff, because while we say anything can happen and it's never decided until the last ballot is cast, do the Democrats have any chance in the fall general election of beating either Fleming or Letlow who emerge from this?
Yeah, I'd have to put it at about a 0.01%. And, you know, I never want to give anything a zero. You know, and that 0.1% says, just in case, you know, there's a scandal we don't know about, or, you know, God forbid something should happen to a candidate. You know, it's not over till it's over. But the realities, the political, the financial, the ideological realities of the field and this state, this is a Republican state. The Democrats are not currently well organized or well financed. And with all due respect, don't have as strong of a candidate as Letlow or Fleming. So it's going to be a very, very, very tough race for the Democrats to win.
Julia Letlow going into this, and it's actually kind of a funny story that she hadn't even decided to run yet. And she met President Trump or saw President Trump at an event. And she actually, her engagement happened at that event. Her now fiance had proposed to her and the president brought them up and congratulated them. And then without even her having formed a campaign or made an announcement that she was going to run for Senate, the president said he was endorsing her for U.S. Senate. So now she's got President Donald Trump pretty much telling her, you should run for office and you have my support. So she did. And that has kind of been the focus of this whole thing ever since, is President Trump did not like the incumbent because the incumbent voted to impeach him during his first term. Cassidy was on the president's bad list, and Letlow emerged as his way to try and get rid of Cassidy. That was the focus of the primary. I haven't seen a single commercial with President Trump endorsing Letlow since the primary election. And if they're running, they're not running nearly as frequently as they did before. And I know that John Fleming has talked to the president since then and reminded the president he worked for him in his first administration and had suggested to the president that he should be the president's candidate. That all having been said, with voters so focused on getting rid of Bill Cassidy because Donald Trump wanted him out of office and driving voters to the poll in the primary, That goal was accomplished. Cassidy's gone now. Is the same motivation there by the MAGA Republicans, by the ardent Donald Trump supporters, to go and support Julia Letlow now? Or will this be determined by turnout and what may be a much lower turnout in this runoff?
Yeah, a lot there. You know, I think the biggest thing that is still on the line a bit is Trump's legacy. You know, Trump did endorse Julia Letlow, and that played a powerful role for Representative Letlow, as many other individuals at local and federal levels across the nation over the last month. So, you know, his endorsement was significant and probably what might have pushed her over the edge with against Senator Cassidy. But Trump's legacy is still on the line here. You know, even though you have endorsed a Republican, and a Republican will likely win, one could say, oh, if Fleming wins, there's no loss there. You know, you don't want any little blemishes on your record. So for Trump's endorsee to win and follow through, that would be the ultimate victory, both for Trump and for Letlow. And since she's a heavy favorite, there's no reason for Trump to waste any more resources, most likely in this state or on behalf of Letlow. He has more competitive races and dollars are finite. So he's going to save those for other critical races across the nation.
And there are other critical races. That's a good point. They know now that he's accomplished his goal of getting rid of Cassidy. Cassidy will not be returning to the U.S. Senate. Now he has to be very focused on trying to maintain the majorities that the Republicans have in the House and the Senate. And that makes sense. But to the turnout issue, here in Louisiana, does Fleming have a better chance than he otherwise would, even though he appears to be behind Letlow in the polls, because turnout may be very low in this because there's not the same intense MAGA drive to the polls that we saw in the effort to make sure that Cassidy didn't return to office?
Yeah, that's a tough question, and I think that's a really good question. The fewer voters that come out means the fewer voters you need to win. And if you're running behind like John Fleming, then a low turnout election could benefit you because a bunch of Letlow supporters say, oh, she's got this in the bag. I'm going to sit this out. There's nothing to worry about here. So if you are the Letlow campaign, you have to be a little bit worried or concerned about voter fatigue or voter apathy. And I think that's why she's keeping up the attack ads, because she's trying to, portray, hey, this race is not over. Anything can happen. So I'm sure Fleming would not be mad about low turnout. But at the same time, in order to win, even under those conditions, he's got to have more advertising, more appearances, and a very, very strong ground campaign.
Yeah, and so much of his campaign, he's had to finance himself with his own millions of dollars, and now he may be in a position where that's getting difficult to do. Joshua Stockley, political science professor at University of Louisiana, anything else you want to share with us as we get ready to start early voting tomorrow in this U.S. Senate race here in Louisiana?
Yeah, I don't. You've got a good handle on this race, and I thank you for putting this race on your calendar and talking about it. And I hope that our eligible voters will continue to vote in this series of elections that we have coming up in Louisiana.
Professor Stockley, thank you so much. I know we'll be talking to you again in the near future, and we'll see how this unfolds with early voting starting tomorrow. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Political science professor Joshua Stockley here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen in for Newell Norman. What do you think? Do you think Letlow's got this in the bag? And do you have a problem with her not granting any media interviews and not participating in any debates and taking a defensive position to protect the lead and just maintaining the message? Donald Trump has endorsed her to be the U.S. Senator from Louisiana, and that's all she needs to say. What do you think? 504-260-1870 and the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. We'll talk about that coming up. We'll also get folks from the Port of New Orleans in here to help us understand what happens back there behind those walls and fences. Really amazing when you start to learn the details of just everything that happens. We're going to talk ship to shelf after this on WWL. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday morning. You ever see a ship going down the Mississippi River, or one of those big cranes with its boom swinging along the riverfront, or one of the many, many trucks we see with those big containers that came off of a ship moving on the interstate around here, or a train with over 100 cars loaded down crossing the tracks? Where all that stuff comes from and where it all goes and how important it is to our economy, I think, you know, a lot of us take it for granted that we have this amazing port that has all of this commerce happening all the time here in New Orleans and Southeast Louisiana. and don't really realize just what's going on over there, how massive an operation it is, and how important it is to our economy. And that's why we do the NOLA Port Show here for you here on WWL. And today, Port NOLA Vice President of Cargo Amanda Coates is joining us, along with Kearney Company's President David Kearney. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Glad you're here. You know, I am amazed by how things work. And that's why I love that we get to talk to folks like you when we do this segment, because it really is amazing when we learn the numbers and the gravity and the importance of it all. So, Amanda, let's start with you. You're talking about something today that you guys call ship to shelf, that I don't think a lot of us realize how this process works. And it really is fascinating, isn't it?
It really is. So most people don't see, they only see this finished product on the shelf, and they don't always see the journey that it takes to get to the port. We help, you know, connect businesses and consumers to products that they use every day, from coffee to clothing, furniture, electronics, automobiles, building materials. All of the things on shelves in retail stores essentially came through a port somewhere. And so, you know, we're, you know, supporting thousands of jobs across transportation, warehousing, manufacturing, retail, logistics, and, you know, just a really important part of our everyday lives. I mean, if you just take our clothes, for example, that we have on, all of that started possibly right, you know, in Louisiana with cotton, and was exported to Central America, Bangladesh, Turkey, and can come back as apparel, sheets, many things like that.
So, yeah, and it goes both ways. That's interesting, right? Because many of the products start here, leave as raw materials, and you export a whole lot through the port, but then it gets re-imported as a finished product that we all can consume. And it really is the vast majority of things that we import don't come in on an airplane, right? They come in on a ship, and they come into the port.
That's right. So lightweight things are, lightweight goods are coming on airplanes. Think like flowers, very high, you know, high quality pharmaceuticals and things like that are coming on airplanes. But everything else comes from a ship. And just like, you know, 66% of Americans are drinking coffee. So let's take the coffee bean, for example. The coffee bean begins its journey on a farm in Central or South America. It's then picked, dried, loaded in containers, transported by vessel to the Port of New Orleans. Once the ship arrives, the container is unloaded, sent to a cleaning and grading and blending facility. From there, it is then taken to a roasting facility. After it's roasted, it's then taken to a distribution center, packaging and distribution facility, and then to our retail store shelves, and sold to consumers. So a long journey that most people don't see.
Yeah, and so much of that happens here. And I don't think we think about the ships that bring it in and the crane operators that unload it and the trucks or trains they place it on and then the distribution from there. And that happens all day, every day at the port, right?
It does. And let me give you a fun fact here. One shipment has over 200 transactions across 20 or more companies. So one shipment.
Before it ends up in our homes or in our hands.
That's right.
Port is also obviously part of, we talk about the supply chain all the time. And to many people, I don't think the supply chain, it sounds like, you know, it's like in the cloud. It's the supply chain. But it's very real and very physical at the port. And every movement that is made there is crucial to companies being able to accomplish their goals of getting materials and delivering products, and individuals being able to then get those products. And that all has to happen in a timely manner, and it has to happen efficiently. And so the port is a hub of the supply chain, right?
Exactly. You know, efficient ports essentially reduce transportation cost. It improves reliability. It helps prevent supply chain disruptions, which really keeps our consumer goods at a level that, you know, we can afford. And as soon as you see that congestion, or, you know, the efficiency dropping, we start to see that on the consumer shelves of higher prices, less options, and things like that.
How much comes through the port? Can you give us any numbers to just understand the gravity? I mean, and I know you talked about clothing, food, cars, building materials, and so much more, but the numbers really are very impressive, aren't they?
They really are. So about 515,000 TEUs, which is a unit of measure for containers, move through the port each year. And just to give you some fun facts, off the top of my head on coffee, it's about 700 million pounds of coffee per year.
Wow.
And that equates to about 20 billion cups of coffee each year.
20 billion cups of coffee without the Port of New Orleans would not be where they are today. That you are distributing 20 billion cups of coffee every year thanks to the role of the Port of New Orleans. Amanda, anything else you want to share with us so we can understand ship to shelf as we talk about Port NOLA here on WWL?
Yeah, I think it's just important, the port is really at the core an economic engine. And every vessel call represents jobs, investment, opportunity for Louisiana, and it also, gets our goods on the shelves.
And crucial in making that happen are companies like the Kearney Companies and President David Kearney with us now. David, we talk about this all kind of in the ethereal and how it's important and all of that. But for you, it's you making a living and you allowing all of your employees to make a living and helping everybody else enjoy their lives, right?
Yeah, we very much look at it as our role in life as a job creator. We're linked very closely with Amanda and her team at the Port of New Orleans. They're really our landlord, if you think of it that way. And through good performance and mutually shared objectives of creating jobs through commerce, we have the right to operate certain facilities that the Port of New Orleans owns. And as such, we use those facilities very carefully to facilitate both domestic and foreign commerce that benefits not just the consumers here in New Orleans, but really consumers, manufacturers, shippers across the whole state of Louisiana and way beyond. I mean, our little company here in New Orleans creates, close to 100 direct jobs with many more indirect jobs. And we're just a tiny little piece of the overall port.
David, I find it funny you're using things like tiny piece and little company when you operate 1.2 million square feet of rail-served warehouse space here in New Orleans and 50 acres of yard capacity. That doesn't sound like a tiny piece and a little company to me.
Yeah, in one port, that is a lot of capacity. But our competition operates across the whole United States. So we see competition from Savannah and, of course, Mobile, Gulfport, Houston regularly. But we can also compete with operators and ports as far away as, Norfolk, Virginia or Los Angeles, California. So we look at competition on a worldwide basis, and that's probably why we maybe feel small sometimes, but
right,
we like to think of ourselves as an underdog, and we work really hard to service our customers and really support jobs here in the region.
You know, I've never really thought, though, in detail until I had to prepare to interview you about how this all works. Never thought about, okay, all this stuff comes in on a ship, whether it's a tanker or a container ship or whatever the case may be. And when it gets here, obviously someone has to take it off of that ship. But you are actually the ones providing the logistics to, does it go on a truck? Does it go on a train? Does it go in a warehouse until it can be moved somewhere else? Because obviously those ships can't sit there forever. So tell us a little bit about how that whole process works and what role you guys play in it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The ships get discharged and all that cargo comes off the vessel and it's temporarily in a holding area, on the terminal. And that's being operated by large terminal operators at the Port of New Orleans, let's say at Napoleon Avenue, at the container terminal. We then take those containers as soon as they're available, meaning they've cleared customs, all of the duties and taxes related to customs and tariffs and all that have been paid, we are then allowed through a very automated system to go pick up those containers and, let's say, bring them to our warehouses here, which are right near the port, but they're considered off-dock facilities. And from there, we empty the container, the contents of each container. Basically, for different commodities, it's different customers that we represent, but it's a similar process for everything we handle. We might pull out copper cathodes or steel coils or rolls of pulp or paper and then redistribute it to other modes, meaning rail, barge, or truck, or we might temporarily hold that cargo until the customer is ready to release it to an end user, because that end user might need more time to prepare for the goods that they had ordered. So there's a very important role that we play to ensure goods arrive on time and really at the lowest landed cost. There's this really important thing about any port is that the supply chains you work on, you're constantly up against reducing costs, keeping costs to a bare minimum. And that's really part of the role we play, is converting goods to a cheaper mode of transportation once it arrives in the container.
Talking with David Kearney and Amanda Coates, talking about Port Nola here on the Newell Norman Show. I'm Dave Cohen. When we come back, we want to talk a little bit more about how does it get determined what comes in and goes out through New Orleans, and what's the competition like to make sure that the Port of New Orleans plays a major role in attracting the biggest and best businesses to come here. I'm Dave Cohen. We'll be back with that after this on WWL. We're talking with Port Nola's Amanda Coates and Kearney Company's David Kearney about everything that goes on the other side of the flood wall and the other side of the levee that is so vital to our lives. David, tell us, what kinds of products do you handle that people might be surprised to find out come in through the part of New Orleans and you make sure get where they're going?
Yeah, you'd be shocked sometimes. The main thing on the import side we see a lot of is commodities like copper cathode, which is something that would come in containers or even comes in traditional vessels and then gets redistributed to basically be used to make wire for your house or wire that you might use to create an electrical motor at a power plant. Certainly wiring for data centers. I know that's been a big topic of conversation.
A lot of that coming in right now, no doubt.
There is. And then on the export side, product going out, which really New Orleans uniquely handles, we're very strong in exports. And that goes to the manufacturing that occurs in our state for things like Kraft liner board. Kraft liner board is simply rolls of packaging material that's used to make cardboard boxes. And as simple as that sounds, we export a lot of Kraft liner board because we have trees, southern yellow pine, which are renewable resources. And through a sustainable forest initiative, the big paper manufacturers like International Paper, Georgia Pacific, they mill pine trees into box board that's shipped all over the world and comes back in an Amazon package. For instance, if you buy something online and it arrives in a corrugated box, that box is made from Kraft liner board.
We all get lots of those almost every day these days.
Exactly. And similarly, there's a lot of plastic that's also handled through the Port of New Orleans. The plastic would be something that's used for packaging primarily.
Gotcha. David, thank you so much. Amanda, this has got to be stiff competition, and congratulations to you and your team that New Orleans plays such a key role in the world's moving of raw materials and finished products. How do you compete, and how do you make sure New Orleans stays crucial and gets so many of these clients?
Well, so New Orleans we have a really unique position in the United States because we really connect global trade directly with America's heartland. So you can access markets into Canada through New Orleans, all along the Mississippi River. Few ports can offer the combination of deep water access that converge with the six Class 1 national railroads, interstate highway access, and the 14,000 miles of inland waterways. And so that's how we really compete with other ports. We're one of the most diversified ports in the country, handling containers, break bulk cargo, project cargo, coffee and copper, like David mentioned. So many different commodities across the agricultural space, and diversification really provides resilience, and it allows us to serve a wide variety of different industries.
Yeah, well, geographically, you have an advantage. It takes people like you, though, to make sure people know that we're here and to get them to do business here. So thank you for what both of you do and for helping drive the economy of New Orleans forward. And thank you for helping us understand all of this here on the Newell Norman Show today. Have a great day and a great weekend.
Thanks.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. All right. We'll be back after this on WWL. All right, folks, don't go away. You know he never pulls punches. Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metro Crime Commission, is coming up next. And he and the Crime Commission have been looking at the arrest of St. Tammany Parish Sheriff Randy Smith and the allegations against him and all of the tentacles this case has grown. And he will share his thoughts and research with us coming up next. He's also got some other stories and information he'll share with us. We welcome you to join the conversation at 504-260-1870. And the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. The news is next.